And then you could see a great, you know, expansion of the war elsewhere. And by the way, you know, although
10 seconds,
the West. Remember, I mean, there are an awful lot of Armenians in America who would not be happy with this development.
And just to be clear, it was a series of unexplained explosions that have occurred in parts of Transnistria, the breakaway territory within Moldova. That does it for our show. Anatol Levin, Senior Fellow at the Quincy Institute. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Stay safe.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO's annual spring membership drive is just getting started, and now is a great time to become a member of KBOO. Go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321 right now. Your donation will be matched dollar for dollar up to $12,000, thanks to the generous support of a group of anonymous donors. Join the KBOO family today and help us meet our $56,000 spring drive.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a big expansion proposed for Portland Street Response, a digital vaccine card to help people more easily identify and verify their protection against COVID-19. And a Portland ballot measure aimed at money for the houseless gets a boost from real estate developers and investors. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, April 28, 2022. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks so much for joining us. If Portland's mayor gets his way, Portland Street Response is about to get a lot bigger. KBOO's Jeffrey Wade has more on the story.
Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler announced on Wednesday his plans to expand the Portland Response Project with a bigger staff and a bigger budget. The program, housed within the Portland Fire Bureau, dispatches a firefighter paramedic, a mental health crisis therapist, and two community health workers to respond to emergency calls that don't require a police response. The responders are unarmed and are aimed at helping situations involving people facing a mental or behavioral crisis. Goals have been set in place for the program to also host de-escalation training for neighborhood associations and businesses and to hold resource fairs in underserved communities. Portland City Commissioner Joanne Hardesty, the architect of Portland Street Response, launched a pilot program in 2020, which began in the Lentz neighborhood of Southeast Portland. After a one-year evaluation on Tuesday, Wheeler reported encouraging data and says expanding the program is part of an effort to refocus the public safety system. Part of the data collected revealed that over 65% of people who contacted Portland Street Response had unmet basic needs and were experiencing homelessness, and just under 60% of those contacts involved people with suspected mental health needs. The program has received over 900 calls in the last year, with most receiving assistance on-site, with many connected to additional follow-up support programs, including 9 cases of people finding housing. The report also showed that no one was harmed during any incidents the teams responded to and that 0 arrests were made. The evaluation was conducted by Portland State University's Homelessness Research and Action Collaborative and has prompted Wheeler to fully fund the program. For starters, Wheeler says he wants to triple the current mental health response teams, and if the proposal is approved by City Council, the teams will be available to provide 24/7 citywide services by early fall. With the KBOO Evening News, I'm Jeffrey Wade.
Some big plans are on the way for Portland Public Schools. KBOO's Josh Salem has the latest.
Portland Public Schools leadership presented a $1.87 billion budget for next year to the school board on Tuesday. The budget is said to reflect student needs from the last 2 years of the pandemic. PPS Superintendent Guadalupe Guerrero said no classroom or licensed educators would be laid off, partly thanks to attrition and retirements. But there would be cuts to classroom positions. Officials plan a reduction of 88 full-time equivalent school employees. PPS Chief Financial Officer Nolberto Delgadillo cited increased costs and a $40 million gap between general fund expenses and revenue. That's why staff recommends the board approve using $40 million from reserves. That would reduce the district's reserves from $91 million to $51 million. The goal would be to gradually build those reserves back up starting in 2023. Board members expressed concern about what dipping into reserves might mean in the future, particularly because there are no specific plans to replenish those funds. Teachers also expressed concerns over class size. There are averages of up to 24 students in K through 5 classrooms and up to 29 in middle school classrooms. Projected class sizes range up to 33 in some elementary schools and 34 in a K-8 and a middle school. Some teachers, parents, and elected officials have suggested PPS spend some of its one-time federal pandemic relief dollars on staff. District officials say they already have. The district plans to devote $118 million in state and federal dollars to help students catch up from the pandemic, provide mental health support and summer programming, and offer professional development to teachers. This includes funds to continue providing some meals to PPS students by shoring up the end of a national lunch program and paying for after-school snacks and other food options. Superintendent Guerrero said, quote, "Arguably, the last couple of years have indeed presented us with unique circumstances. We've never experienced them at this level in the history of public education. It's made the role and importance of our public schools more evident than ever," end quote. The Portland Public Schools Board of Directors will hear from the public about the budget at a work session May 4th, with meetings and other work sessions planned throughout the rest of May. A vote to approve the budget is scheduled for May 24th, with final adoption on June 14th. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
A Portland area ballot measure campaign has received a large financial boost this week from local real estate developers and investors. The ballot aims to redirect most regional homelessness tax revenue to emergency shelters. Voters in Multnomah, Clackamas, and Washington counties created the tax in 2020, and it's since then been championed by a coalition of business groups, nonprofits, and elected leaders collectively known as Here Together. In the last week, 24 donors have donated to a new political action committee called Everyone Deserves Safe Shelter, raising more than $300,000 in support of the proposed measure. Spokespeople from Here Together have raised concern over three of the largest firms' hefty donations, questioning the motivation behind them. The firms in question are Portland-based real estate developer Killian Pacific, Seattle-based real estate investment firm Harmony Capital Investments, and the Singer Family, LLC, a Portland-based real estate developer known for owning many buildings along Northwest 23rd Avenue. They each gave $50,000. In November, local businesses formed the Downtown Portland lobbying group called People for Portland, which is pushing for county governments to spend 75% of those tax proceeds to create more temporary emergency homeless shelters instead of rental assistance, mental health services, and other related programs to help keep people housed. The ballot's also controversial because it wants to enforce the anti-camping laws that are already on the books. Lawyers for Metro, the regional land use government agency, say the proposed measure does not meet constitutional precedent. People for Portland have pushed back against Metro's analysis, saying it is flatly contrary to Oregon law. A judge expects to rule soon on the constitutionality of the ballot measure, which will likely determine its future. Oregon launched a $2.45 million app this week to help people more easily identify and verify their vaccination records against COVID-19. The Oregon Health Authority had originally made claims the app would be available by the end of March, but the official rollout didn't happen until Monday, when it was announced on Twitter that people could start signing up for it. By Tuesday, more than 1,420 people had already registered, according to OHA spokesperson Rudy Owens. In an email earlier this week, Owens said, "The My Electronic Vaccine Card provides an equitable and accessible means for all individuals to maintain their important health records while providing a convenience factor so residents don't have to worry about not having it or losing their cards if they need to use them." This comes, however, after state officials earlier this year lifted requirements, prompting many but not all businesses to reduce or stop masking measures and vaccination checks. OHA officials have not said how many people are expected to use the app, and some criticism has been raised regarding whether the app's hefty price tag justifies the amount of people who may or may not use the tool. Oregon worked closely with Washington and California on the creation of the app, which is available in 13 languages. Some state businesses, including restaurants, bars, movie theaters, and live show events, may still require proof of COVID-19 vaccination, which has previously meant people showing their physical card or a photo of it on their cell phone. OHA's app aids people who were vaccinated in Oregon with another option, digital QR code access by cell phone that can be scanned by businesses that document the person's identity, date of birth, dates of vaccination, and what type of vaccine was received. For anyone wishing to download the app, they can go to myelectronicvaccinecard.oregon and enter their personal information to get the QR code. That code can be stored on their phone as a photo, downloaded and printed as a PDF file, and physically printed out or in a digital wallet. In addition to the new app, it remains likely businesses will still accept previous methods of showing proof of vaccination if those records are still required. As America's public health emergency comes to an end, experts worry that the impact will weigh heavily on the most vulnerable among us. I talked to Dr. Julie Morita, the executive vice president of the country's largest health philanthropy, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. You're here because there's a lot of concern about what's going to happen as we draw down from the pandemic. There have been a lot of public health supports that have been installed basically during the pandemic that could be taken away. So tell me about your concerns with this as a doctor.
Right. I think it's really important to acknowledge that when the public health emergency was declared in January of 2022, there were a lot of protective measures that were made available to the public. And they really have served as the cornerstone of the federal response COVID-19. And it really has, some of these protective measures have really saved countless lives and helped those most at risk keep themselves and their families safe. So there were critical measures like making COVID testing and vaccines available at no cost. Things like making sure there was access to telehealth services so people didn't have to go in and visit their doctors. They could do virtual meetings for mental health or physical health visits. And also things like continuing Medicaid coverage, so people didn't just get dropped from Medicaid if there was a question of their eligibility or whether their addresses had changed. Those kinds of things really made a difference in terms of people being able to access the critical care that was necessary during the pandemic.
So are you basically concerned that people's lives and health are at risk now?
I think the good news is the pandemic, that though disease activity is on the rise throughout the nation, we're seeing that hospitalizations and deaths are not, and that's a reassuring sign from a pandemic perspective. But that doesn't mean that we still need to have these protective measures in place. And these measures are in place right now, but when the public health emergency ends, and it's scheduled to end in the middle of July, millions of people can lose access to free vaccines, free testing. They can also lose access to healthcare services overall, and they can also lose access to these telehealth services. So now is the time for the federal government and state governments to do things to actually set up those systems so that people just don't lose their coverage abruptly when the public health emergency ends.
Mm-hmm. What are you seeing going on in the Pacific Northwest specifically, which is where our audience is?
I mean, I think it's throughout the nation, these kinds of protective measures are necessary. And the Northwest is no different than the rest of the United States in doing things to protect these services. So many states can start acting now to make sure that there are people out there enrolling those that might lose coverage from Medicaid into the Affordable Care Act plans, because that can happen right now. There is also work at the state level that can be done to really strengthen the systems that Medicaid uses to evaluate whether or not a person is eligible for the Medicaid services so that they don't automatically get dropped and that the processes are simple enough for people to update so that people don't lose coverage unnecessarily. We hear time and time again throughout the nation about people losing access to their coverage inappropriately. They remain eligible, but the systems are so cumbersome, they're not able to obtain their status.
Who is at most risk in this situation, do you think?
Maybe what we've seen with the pandemic is that there are certain populations who are higher risk for worse health outcomes, our low-income communities, our communities of color, our disability communities. Those groups have been really impacted disproportionately with worse health outcomes as a result of the pandemic. And they're also at greater risk if Medicaid insurance eligibility declines or people aren't able to retain their services. If telehealth services aren't available, they also lose access to those services. So there are, while everybody is impacted by these changes, there are some groups that are impacted even more.
Okay. So you're saying basically people of color, lower income people are still going to be even more at risk after the pandemic.
If the systems and fixes by the federal government and the state government aren't put in place, those communities will be hit hardest by the lack of support. But other communities will also be impacted by it. Mm-hmm.
What's the cost of keeping these programs going?
You know, I don't have a dollar figure for how much it would cost to retain these services, but we clearly have reaped the benefits of these programs through the pandemic, and there's a lot of good lessons that can be learned regarding the value and the benefits of these health services being available. We have saved millions of lives, and people have benefited and been able to protect their families and themselves from the ill effects of the pandemic because of these protective measures. And we don't need to just have these systems in place during a pandemic. We really need to have them existing at baseline so all our communities are able to be healthy.
Do you think that lives are at risk if we don't have these systems in place?
Certainly. I think what we feel like is if people lose their health care coverage, they will no longer be able to access preventive health services or necessary treatments in people's lives. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. Anything else I haven't asked you about that you would like to add?
I think you covered a lot of great issues, so I don't.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for spending some time with me today. I really appreciate it. Okay.
Thank you.
And that was my conversation with Dr. Julie Morita with the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Making Contact. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 7, it's the Indigenous Power Hour. Tonight's weather, rain showers this evening with mostly cloudy conditions overnight, a low down to 41. Tomorrow's weather, cloudy skies with periods of light rain later in the day, a high near 60. Today in history, on this date in 1945, Benito Mussolini, the deposed former dictator of Italy, was executed as he tried to flee to Switzerland. The quote of the day is from Mussolini, "Where ignorance speaks, intelligence should not give advice." Washingtonians are recognizing workers who died on their jobs. In 2021, that happened to more than 100 people statewide. Eric Tegedoff has this story on Workers' Memorial Day.
Today is Workers' Memorial Day, honoring people who died while on the job. Events are planned across Washington State to mark the day. Tina Morrison is with the Spokane Regional Labor Council, which is holding a ceremony for workers on Saturday. She says 106 workers died in Washington State from preventable illness or injury in 2021.
Our vision is that no worker should be exposed to illness and that safety protocols should be developed enough that workers can go to work to put food on their family's tables and go home to their family safely.
Workers' Memorial Day is marked on April 28th, the anniversary of the signing of the Occupational Safety and Health Act in 1970. The Washington State Department of Labor and Industries is holding its event virtually today. Ricky Camacho is a psychology associate at Western State Hospital and member of the Washington Federation of State Employees. Workers at her hospital are holding an event today in Lakewood. She says the day also recognizes people who have been injured on the job, which is a major concern at Western State Hospital. Camacho says there are ways to make her workplace safer.
One of the biggest things is that we're chronically understaffed, and so if there's more of a staff presence on the ward, then the patients feel safer too, and they're less likely to start acting in unsafe ways.
More than 400 Western State Hospital and Eastern State Hospital employees signed petitions to the Washington State Department of Social and Health Services calling for safer working conditions, including more training for interacting with patients. Morrison says it's important to fund federal agencies such as OSHA as well, and that everyone has a role to play.
We need to keep the focus on workplace safety and make sure that people understand that there are things that they can do to help create a safer workplace, and that employers also should be committed to helping us do that.
For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Groups fighting for labor and immigration issues are planning to march on the Las Vegas Strip this Sunday night in honor of May Day. They're calling on President Joe Biden to remove Title 42 restrictions on refugees, as Suzanne Potter reports.
This Sunday night, immigration and labor groups are marching on the Las Vegas Strip for May Day, speaking out on the need for immigration reform and union jobs. May Day is traditionally a day to honor workers. Rico Ocampo with Make the Road Nevada wants the feds to lift the CDC order based on Title 42. The order was a Trump-era rule that allowed border agents to summarily reject people seeking asylum without hearing their case in the name of protecting the U.S. from COVID.
A Title 42 is not a public health measure, and instead it's being used as a ploy to stop immigration at the border.
A federal judge recently temporarily blocked the administration's plan to lift the order. The groups are also calling on Congress to pass comprehensive immigration reform. Organizers are expecting about 200 people to gather at 6 p.m. at the Bellagio Fountain and march to the Statue of Liberty in front of New York, New York. Ocampo says the marchers also will call on casino management to rehire those left jobless by the lockdown.
We want to ensure that union members who had a job before the pandemic have their job back. With that, we can truly transform this city into a more inclusive place to live.
People can learn more on the Make the Road Nevada Facebook page. I'm Suzanne Potter.
Massachusetts investigates companies promoting opioids. The U.S. and Russia trade prisoners. New York goes back to the redistricting drawing board. And Derek Chauvin asks an appeals court to review his murder conviction. With more on the stories impacting our democracy, here's today's edition of 2022 Talks.
McKinsey designed schemes to get more people on opioids, and as a result, more people suffered and died.
Massachusetts Attorney General Mara Healey testified Wednesday on the state's investigation into McKinsey and Company and congressional committee allegations the company hid its work for Purdue Pharma, manufacturer of OxyContin, while also advising the Food and Drug Administration. The U.S. Supreme Court heard oral arguments this week over the Trump-era Remain in Mexico policy, which forced asylum seekers to wait in Mexico while their cases played out in U.S. courts, often in dangerous conditions. Senior Policy Counsel at the American Immigration Council, Aaron Reichlin-Melnick.
This is a pretty outrageous idea that a new president coming into office is not allowed to dismantle his predecessor's programs that he disagrees with. And that is largely what was at stake.
Meanwhile, Republicans, including Pennsylvania Senator Rob Portman, continue to criticize President Biden on his decision to lift Title 42 COVID-19 restrictions at the border.
For people who believe like I do, we have a dramatic and desperate crisis of national security at our southern border. I will tell you, if they eliminate Title 42, it's going to get a lot worse.
The Biden administration and the family of Trevor Reed say the U.S. Marine veteran is out of Russian prison and safely on his way back to the U.S. Reed was exchanged for jailed Russian pilot Konstantin Yaroshenko in a prisoner swap. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki.
Trevor's freedom is the result of months and months of hard, careful work across the U.S. government.
About 500 people have died in gun violence in the U.S. so far in 2022, according to the latest data from the Gun Violence Archive. Daniel Webster from the Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Violence Solutions on the largest single-year increase in gun violence on record from 2019 to 2020.
This pattern that we see overall in gun violence is also seen in mass shootings.
New York's highest court Wednesday rejected new congressional maps widely seen as favoring Democrats, largely agreeing with Republican voters who argued district boundaries were unconstitutionally gerrymandered. Finally, 1 year after he was convicted of murdering George Floyd, former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin has filed an appeal to overturn the jury's verdict and reduce his sentence. Chauvin wants the Minnesota Court of Appeals to either toss his conviction and send his case back to Hennepin County, reverse the result and order a new trial in a new venue, or sentence him to a lesser punishment. I'm Nadia Ramlagan.
The Supreme Court hears concerns over the landmark McGirt versus Oklahoma ruling. The University of California president offers full rides to members of recognized tribes. UNR launches Native College Prep Camp in South Lake Tahoe. A Montana tribal college offers a natural resource management grad program. And a new bill in Congress seeks to transfer more than 1,000 acres back to a tribe. With more, Here's today's edition of National Native News.
Both sides presented oral arguments to the U.S. Supreme Court Wednesday to address jurisdictional concerns by the state of Oklahoma since the landmark 2020 McGirt versus Oklahoma decision. That 5-4 ruling went in favor of tribes who maintained the state never properly dissolved reservations, and so major crimes involving Native defendants belong in the purview of the federal government, not the state. The current case asks whether the state has authority to prosecute non-Native defendants who commit crimes on Indian land. A ruling in the state's favor would narrow the scope of the McGirt decision. During the arguments, Justice Stephen Breyer noted a ruling in favor of Oklahoma in this case could overturn what has been longstanding practice in all 50 states. Some doors to higher education are opening up and some barriers are coming down for Native Americans in California. The University of California is offering full scholarships to Native Americans to any campus in the UC system. The effort is part of a new program called the UC Native American Opportunity Plan. Right now, about 1% of the 280,000 UC students is Native American. Across California, the U.S. Census shows 1.6% of residents identify as American Indian and Alaska Native. Another group trying to boost that percentage of Native Americans in colleges is launching a special summer camp program. The aim is to offer resources, support, and assistance to high school students wanting to attend college. The American Indian Alaska Native College Prep Camp is happening June 6th through 10th in South Lake Tahoe. The camp will help prepare students for the application process, obtain financial aid, and be successful at college life. It will also feature activities to help the youth build self-esteem and see that attending college is an attainable goal. A tribal college in northwest Montana is taking applications for a resource management graduate program that is the first of its kind in the country. Aaron Bolton has that.
The Salish Kootenai College launched the program this fall that aims to train the next generation of fire, wildlife, and forest managers in the Columbia River Basin in Montana, Idaho, Washington, and Oregon. This is the first master's program at the Pablo-based four-year school on the Flathead Indian Reservation. It's also the first resource management graduate program housed at a tribal college in the U.S., according to the American Indian College Fund. The Salish Kootenai College worked with the University of Idaho to develop the curriculum. In a press release, the school says it's working to provide opportunities for faculty exchanges with the University of Idaho and the opportunity for Salish Kootenai students to do lab work at the university. Applications for next fall's program will be accepted through May 13th. For National Native News, I'm Aaron Bolton.
A California congressman has introduced legislation to return more than 1,000 acres of historically Native American land back to the Yurok tribe. Currently, the tribe owns less than a quarter of its approximately 500,000 acre ancestral land base. Timber companies, national and state parks, and other owners occupy that land now. During the last decade, the Yurok tribe has recovered approximately 70,000 acres of former timberlands on and near the Yurok Reservation, which straddles the lower 44 miles of the Klamath River in Northern California. With National Native News, I'm Shirley Jihad.
In a January poll, 64% of respondents said they work from home because their office was closed. But 36% chose to work from home despite their offices being open. As Jonah Chester reports, experts say we should keep healthy habits in mind while working from home.
While working from home, it can be tempting to lounge on the couch while firing off emails. But health experts are urging folks to take a long overdue look at their home office setup. A 2016 report by the United States Bone and Joint Initiative estimates half of all U.S. adults suffer from some form of musculoskeletal ailment, an issue which costs the nation about $213 billion in treatment and lost wages each year pre-pandemic. Dr. Russell Amundson with UnitedHealthcare says the pivot to working from home has exacerbated the issue.
They're working from household furniture in a non-ergonomic setting. And with that, they lose some of that support. And that has actually, research has shown, that's contributed to a spike in low back pain among folks working from home.
Amundson notes about 80% of Americans will have some form of musculoskeletal condition at some point in their lifetime. He says a few simple steps can address the issue, including focusing on posture, staying active, and considering purchasing ergonomic home office equipment. Dr. Nikki Weiner is with the Rising Workplace, an ergonomic consulting agency that operates in Denver and several other cities across the country. She says many ergonomic and musculoskeletal issues are due to improper laptop usage.
We see a lot of neck and back discomfort. And if you look at that in groups of people who are not using an external mouse and keyboard and separating their screen, so raising their screen to a higher level so that you're not constantly hunched over the laptop, we see a higher level of discomfort in that group.
In a January Pew Research Center poll, about 60% of respondents with jobs that could be done remotely indicated they were telecommuting either full-time or most of the time. That's down from about 70% in October 2020. For the Colorado News Connection, I'm Jonah Chester.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, April 28, 2022. This is a volunteer produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem, Jeffrey Wade, Eric Tegedoff, Lily Bolke, and Suzanne Potter. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support your local community radio station, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Making Contact.
Making contact.
Making contact.